You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My name is Doug Paul. I'm Vice President for Studies here. This morning, we're doing an unusual and very welcome event, which is to harness the resources of a variety of institutions in Washington to look at the product of the IMF on a very hot topic. There's probably no more frequent buzzword in the economic world than rebalancing since the economic crisis and the emergence of the G20, and the IMF has taken a close look at it. We have panelists this morning who will be talking to introduce the volume, which is for sale at the back of the hall when the meeting's over, and to present some of the results. Vivek Arora will present some of the results after Dr. Minju gives some introductory remarks. And then we've got two really wonderful commentators from across the street at the Peterson Institute. We have Nick Lardy, and from down the street and with some association at SAIS, at the Johns Hopkins SAIS, and with some association with Carnegie, Dr. Peter Beautellier, both of whom have extensive experience in writing on the Chinese and Asian economies. And on the topic of rebalancing, they've been very astute observers as well. So I would like to get us started. We have a little bit of a late start, and I apologize for that. Let me, at the outset, remind you, please, to turn off your cell phones and your BlackBerries so we can proceed without interruption. We'll have a nice Q&A period at the end of the presentations, so please be patient, and we'll get to that in due course. And let me therefore now turn the platform over to Dr. Minju, who is here from the IMF, to make a few introductory remarks before he has to depart for another engagement.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug, for organizing this. Is a wonderful event, and also thanks, Nick and Peter, you know, coming to join, being the panelists for this morning. I understand that you're obviously very, very busy. We're very happy to have this opportunity to launch one of our the fun stuffs, you know, the works, and convert it into a book. But Vivek, the first question is, are you giving people a free copy for the book, or?
I'll have to ask my colleagues. I'm not in charge of the circulation.
What does that mean? So that means no. Oh, that's too bad. So someone waving ahead. Or at least we should give some big discount.
I think there is actually a discount.
Okay, yeah. I mean, what's the purpose for, right? I mean, you should give the people book, so people can read. Or maybe next time you should pay for the bill.
Give them the Carnegie free and we'll sell them.
Aha! Uh-huh. Wow! I saw the issue. I saw that you can pay the bill. I mean, someone have to pay the bill. I mean, but no. Seriously, I think we should. It should be a sort of rule. And anytime we do the book fair, and we should give people book, right? I mean,
you've really raised the interest of the audience by talking.
Yeah. No, we should do that. So then I can take a book. I mean, by the way, I can tell you the book is pretty expensive. It's $30 for only 162 pages, and which is, I don't know where this money goes to publish it or go to Vivek. I don't know, mate. So, but anyway, really, Vivek, and we should talk to EXI, try to come up with some idea to solve this issue. I mean, it's one thing. The book is there, so I guess I'm not sure whether I'm a salesperson or what is my position today. But I think a book is there. It doesn't need me to say very much. We have two, you know, excellent panelists that probably give an in-depth analysis or comments on the whole things. So let me say a few things a little bit further, then go back to the book. I think the imbalance thing is such a big issue. But what we thought is, it's really a deep root. The crisis changed a few things, but I would say the one really the crisis changes, it changed the global growth pattern or growth structures. It's the first time we saw in the past 2 to 3 years, and the advanced economy had a slower growth. Advanced economy experienced high financial debts, high budgetary debts, high unemployment rates, and the low interest rates, and the low growth. On the other side, it's the first time it's emerging market had a lower financial debts, lower budgetary debts, lower unemployment rates, high interest rates, and strong growth. In the last year, global have a 5% GDP growth rates, and emerging market lead by 7.1%, and advanced economy is 3%. And in Asia particularly, it's 9%. This year, we forecast the global GDP growth will be 4.4%. And again, emerging market will lead roughly by 6.2-6.3%, advanced economy 2.5%. And Asia, again, 8.3-8.5%. When the growth rates change, the contribution to the global growth also changes. In the 60s, emerging markets contributed roughly 22% global GDP growth. In 80, 32%. Last year, 69.2% of growth come from emerging and developing countries. The world is changing.
Goodbye.
Should I go?
Please turn them off.
Bye-bye to whom? Bye-bye to the old format. When the growth pattern changes, the global economy structure changes as well. 30 years ago, emerging market and low-income countries contributed roughly 32% of global GDP, PPP measure, because that's the only way to measure together, we use that. Last year, emerging market and the developing country contribute roughly 48% of the global GDP. So the whole thing of Chelsea is a change of a growth rate, a change of a contribution to the global growth, and changing of a global stake, the GDP pie. And if the growth rates change, if the growth, is this pattern keep, say, in, you know, like next 1 to 2 years, so we'll see the two sides hold 50-50. The world is changing. A lot of talk about, you know, power shifting, but I guess we are economists. This is not our language, you know. This is, you know, political analysts and
journalists.
But there are a lot of economic implications. Yeah. And when you see the growth gravity change, a very important issue, you understand, this is 1 billion people living in the advanced economy. It's 3 billion people living in the emerging market. So when growth happens in 3 billion people areas, it changes a lot of demand functions. For example, when the GDP increases in the emerging market, the people consume much more power than the energy. When people have a better housing, more space, have more TV and more cars, they consume much more copper and aluminum. So they change the whole thing on the demand, on the commodity and energies. If you go back to Japan case and the Korean case, you will see during the takeoff in 17 and 80s in Japan, in 80 and 19 South Korea, we will see the demand for the commodity is really taken off. And this time, we will see emerging economy, including China, together, shift the whole demand function. It's a whole demand function shifting on the commodity and the energies. It's also happened on the food, on agri products. Because when people have a more income, they have a better diet, right? And people eat more meat. So what happened is in the past 10, 15 years, the rice price increased rather moderately, wheat price increased to a certain degree, but really increased what? It's a corn and a soybean. Why corn and soybean? Because they feed animals. When Japan reached $15,000 per capita GDP, you see the curve, demand curve for meat really increased. You know, the slope changed. But when South Korea reached $15,000 per capita GDP, the per capita consumption of beef is actually 2 times as high as the Japanese level, at the same $15,000 GDP level. China today is a $5,000 per capita GDP level. Chinese consumption of meat is almost Korea level, at the $15,000 GDP per capita level. So demand on agro, on food curve shift. If you're looking for financial sector, yes, today the emerging market development countries contribute to roughly 48% by end of last year global GDP, but they only has 18.2% of global financial assets. 18.2, roughly 82% of financial assets is in the advanced economy. So it's a reason we see the capital flow moving away from the advanced economy to the emerging market. People talk it's the hard money. I say, wait a second. It's not hard money because the financial portfolio followed the real economy structure change and will gradually match the change. That's a permanent movement, which is at the starting point of that movement. The financial, the capital flow, the financial resources will move into the emerging market. So it's a very, very different things. A lot of, but then you will say, wait seconds. When you say that, you have a very strong assumption. The assumption is or was the growth pattern, like we observe in the past 2 to 3 years, will maintain. That's a good question. A lot of evidence says the growth pattern may maintain because we saw a lot of potential in the emerging market because labor costs are still lower, resources are still ample, the demand is huge, urbanization drive the whole thing, and we still saw that, and the financial market developments and industry structure change, we still saw that. And we saw advanced economy relatively still with the high government debts, high financial debts, and with the productivity change is quite flat in the past few years. The growth may remain. But the other side argument is, the first issue is if you're really looking for the growth drive force in the past 5 years or 10 years in emerging market and low-income country, it is very much driven by the growth from advanced economy, which is a demand-driven growth for the emerging market. Because in the advanced economy, they have a debt-financing growth model, debt-financing consumption-driven growth model. Emerging low-income country have exports investments-driven growth model. But now pattern change, because advanced economy had a rather weaker growth, it will not be able to provide a strong demand for the emerging market and for low-income countries' exports. So the strong momentum may not necessarily be able to maintain. The second point in this line is, because the shifting on the demand curve on the commodity, energy, and on food may also not necessarily be sustainable. Because the supply side change not necessarily meet the demand curve shift. It can meet a certain demand change. We'll not go back to 1960 Roman Club statements, but we do see that there's issues. And we do see that, for example, energy efficiency become an important issue. We do see the pollution, environmental protection. We see the climate change also become so important issue today. So that growth may not necessarily be able to sustain. I think a strong emerging market low-income growth is good news because millions and millions of people are out of poverty, and people become rich, and the living standard increase, which improves the whole well-being of the world. Right. We saw the convergence because the emerging economy developers tried to pick it up. I think this has increased the whole social welfare for the whole world. It's great, great news. But still, whether it's sustainable? Let's come to the issue of a rebalancing. A lot of talk about rebalancing emphasizes on the overconsumption and the less consumption, over-saving and less saving. I think a lot of discussion about that. And also a part of exchange rates. I think exchange rates also played a certain role there. But if you were looking for the rebalancing issue, looking for the sustainability of growth from the emerging market and from low-income countries and from the whole world, we need to go further. It is really the key issue for emerging market, changing the growth model from pure demand-driven to supply-driven. From pure exports and export-led investment-driven to the internal industry structure change and industry structure change supported in the internal consumption-driven growth model. Because anytime we talk internal consumption-driven growth model, the first question is, yes, you want the people to consume more. Everybody wants to consume more. The first issue is, where's the money? People say redistribution. Yes, that's important. But before the redistribution, the key issue, you have to make people earn more money. Right? That's the fundamental. You want people to earn more money. The fundamental issue is you have to change your industry structure. That's the whole history of a human being in the past 300 years. We observed the whole thing happen in the UK 250 years ago. We observed the whole thing happen in the United States in this country roughly 150 years ago. And then we observed those things happen in Japan, South Korea. And we thought some things happen, you know, in emerging markets those days. So this is a whole supply side change, the whole industry structure change, and the whole income structure pattern change. Then we move into new things. So global imbalance thing is absolutely important issue. It's important for emerging market because I feel the sort of demand-driven growth model for emerging market is very much hit its limit because, as I said, the growth pattern change. You don't have a strong external demand. And the constraint from resource, from commodity, energy, from food, and from environmental concerns, from climate change, also is become more and more real. So you have to change. But it is very much inside-driven issues. It's obvious it's a global issue, it's external, but I think this is from emerging market point of view, so you have to look in the inside, have to start to change within inside from more demand side and looking for the whole thing. I think the book actually chipping and contributors debating, because the book really talk about in some sense consumption, you talk about the household consumption, corporate consumption, government consumption. You talk about saving, you talk about government saving, corporate saving, and household saving. You talk about investments, and you know it's also in different things. It's not a simple, just a general thing. And I think the book also has another good point, which is even in the Asia, every country have a very different situation. So if you take this very much inward-driven change structure issues, so you really need and will have a very different macro policy. It's not the one size policy for the whole things. So I think this is the beginning. This is a long debating, but I'm happy this book, my colleague Vivek, you know, and bring this issue and give more details, I'm sure. And Nick and Peter will have much, much more profound thoughts and on these issues. But I just give some of my thoughts for you and for today's talk. Thank you again for your attending here and the support for the founder work. And thank you, Doug, for the whole thing again.
Thank you, Dr. Ju, for framing the issues for us this morning and doing it with such vigor and force. I know you have to go off to another meeting, board meeting, so he's departing. But it's a pleasure now to turn to Vivek Arora to give us a presentation of some of the findings in the new IMF volume.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know Vivek stuff a thousand times, but I will miss Nick and Peter. So very sorry about that. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug, and thank you also to the Carnegie Endowment for hosting this event. Very happy to be here. And I'm also very grateful to all of you for attending this morning. We didn't really expect so many people to attend. We're very happy that you could come. I want to thank also Mr. Jumin for his kind remarks, and also Nick Lardy and Peter Botelier, who are experts for many years on Asian economic issues, particularly on China. In fact, given the expertise of the panel on China, I thought that I'd focus my remarks a little bit more broadly on Asia as a whole. I'll say some things about China, but I thought I can make some points more broadly about Asia. The book is largely about China, but I thought I'd, in the spirit of the talk, I'd rebalance my remarks towards Asia. I also note the footnote at the fund. They tend to make us put this in, that I'm speaking in my own capacity, not in the official capacity of the fund. And also, before I begin, I should make clear that the research that's presented in the book was actually done by 11 economists at the fund. They are listed here. I can see at least Olaf, Unto Oberdorster, and Papa Njie in the audience. Maybe there are some more. Some of this work was done in the context of our regular country research, mainly by the China team, and some of it was done in the context of our regional research, particularly the regional economic outlook that is published every April and every October. Also, before discussing the challenge of Asia's rebalancing, which looks like it's a policy problem that Asia needs to address, I thought it's worth giving you a little bit about the background and the genesis of the book. I think many of you are, I can already see some very familiar faces, but I know that many of you are Asia experts. You know the background about Asian experience very well, so maybe I can just keep it very brief. We all know about Asia's remarkable economic performance in recent decades, but still some of the basic facts are still quite astounding. We know that, as Mr. Jumin was saying, that Asia has recovered very strongly from the from the global financial crisis. Before that, in the late 1990s, Asia faced the Asian financial crisis and recovered very strongly after that as well. And now Asia is leading the global recovery. Looking at a longer period, over the last 30 years or so, economic growth in Asia has averaged about 7% per year. 7% per year means that GDP doubles every 10 years. That means that over 30 years, GDP doubles three times. So after 10 years, GDP is twice what it was. In 1990, GDP was twice what it was in 1980. In 2000, it's four times what it was in 1980. And by 2010, it's eight times what it was in 1980. So in the space of a single generation, GDP in Asia, in emerging Asia, has increased eightfold. And that, in previous economic history, such a large increase in living standards has never been seen in such a short span of time. That's partly because of China, but it's also true across many other Asian countries. There's Korea, there's the newly industrializing economies, and there are other examples. As a consequence, the share of emerging Asia in the world economy at market exchange rates has risen to about one quarter as of last year. So Asia as a whole, the Asian economy as a share of the world economy is larger than the US or the Euro area. Although, of course, Asia is a group of countries, not one, but still, as an economic force, it's sizable now. The experience of Asia's development was briefly interrupted in the late 1990s, as we know, by the Asian crisis. But subsequently, there were strong efforts to implement reforms, strengthen institutions, and so on. And I think that those measures seem to have paid off. And as I said, Asia is now leading the global recovery. A lot has been written, researched, and discussed about how Asia managed such tremendous success in such a short space of time. That's beyond the scope of this book, so I won't go into it now, but I just make the point that the general idea there was that Asia's success has to a large extent owed to outward-oriented growth. The most prominent example, of course, is China. China's reform and opening up basically was a move towards giving market forces greater play in the economy, and also opening up the economy to foreign investment and foreign trade, and in particular, encouraging the production of tradable goods. And that general orientation of encouraging tradable production has been a common theme across Asia. Against this background, against this overall very strong performance, however, policymakers and other observers in Asia and in other parts of the world have come to realize in recent years that for Asia to sustain this very strong growth going into the future, the impetus that's been provided by exports and tradable goods production to date needs now to be balanced by a second engine of growth. Question is why? I think the most immediate answer is because of the global financial crisis. That the global financial crisis has reduced the ability of advanced countries to spend as much as they were doing before the crisis, and the reduced demand from advanced countries translates into lower import demand. And lower import demand by advanced countries means that there's lower demand for Asian exports. So Asia faces the situation of either having lower growth in the future than the past, or of rebalancing towards domestic demand if it is to sustain strong growth in the future. This, I think, also has been discussed quite well and widely. You know, I think, the background very well, so maybe I don't need to dwell on it much more than this. Against this background, some of the main questions that were discussed in the book are, first of all, why does Asia need rebalancing? I think I've just covered a bit of why that might be the case. And secondly, what does rebalancing entail? The main idea there is that rebalancing growth entails different things for different countries. Some countries need actually to boost investment, like in Indonesia, the Philippines, many countries in the ASEAN. Investment is quite low. In some other parts of the region, like Japan, the newly industrialized economies like Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, and so on, and China, investment is not low, investment is high, but that investment is very heavily concentrated in tradable goods. So the challenge going forward is to reorient that investment away from production for exports towards production for the home market. And finally, there are some countries, mainly China, which need to boost consumption. So there are these sort of three broad challenges: boosting consumption, which is largely a China issue; reorienting investment from traded to non-traded goods, which is a China issue but also applies to Japan and some of the more advanced economies. And then there's a need in some of the ASEAN economies in particular, and maybe some other parts of Asia, to actually raise overall investment as a share of GDP. So the first three chapters of the book, what we call part one, look at some themes for Asia as a whole. And then the bulk of the book, the second five chapters, which is part two, look at China in particular. In terms of the main themes that we stress on Asia, there are three broad themes. One, to document and highlight the fact that Asia is actually highly dependent on external demand. The work on the book was done during a time when people were asking whether Asia can grow independently of the rest of the world. So if, you know, even if the U.S. recession is prolonged or the financial crisis, financial downturn persists, is there a way in which Asia will find its own growth path automatically? I think chapter one of the book looks at that and concludes that actually Asia is still very highly dependent on external demand. A second feature that we stress is corporate saving, that corporate saving has risen very sharply over the past decade in China as well as in other parts of Asia. And that is one of the big contributors to the rise in national saving. In China, the high corporate saving has been accompanied by high investment. But in the rest of Asia, investment has been low. So the rise in corporate saving against the face of flat investment has been a contributor directly to the rise in external imbalances. And then lastly, as I said, the feature of high investment is not actually common across Asia. Investment is high in China, but in many other countries, investment is low. And the policy question that those countries face is, what are the main constraints to investment and how to address those constraints? So there's a chapter in the book that looks at that. Specifically on China, the chapters look at three broad questions. One is, what are the prospects for continuing with the export-oriented growth model? Secondly, there are some concerns that if China moves away from export-oriented growth, then given that so many people are employed in the export-producing sectors, doesn't that mean a big dislocation to employment? And is that a plausible sort of proposal or strategy to consider? So one of the chapters actually looks at what the implications for employment might be. And then there are various challenges associated with raising household consumption, which has fallen to very low levels in China. So we talk about that as well. I should say that we do not actually discuss a lot the global picture. I mean, we focus basically on Asia and the challenges of rebalancing for Asia. Obviously, Asia is part of the world, and what happens in Asia affects global imbalances. That's not something that we look at in the book, but I just mention it as by way of background. That I think one conclusion that we would reach is that while Asia does need to do a lot to rebalance growth and has actually started to do a lot, Asia on its own cannot rebalance the world economy. It needs a coordinated effort by other major players in the world as well. On the issue of global imbalances, just a couple of observations. First is that during the 1980s and 1990s, there was actually no big imbalance coming out of Asia. That in the 1980s, Asia ran a current account deficit of about 0.5% of GDP. In the 1990s, it ran a surplus of about 0.5% of GDP. So not very big imbalance. But in the last decade, the surplus rose very sharply, particularly from 2003. There has been some moderation in the surplus in 2009 and 2010, which is basically the pink and the green, if you can read that, on the rightmost bars. The green is China, the pink is emerging Asia. That you can see had become quite large from 2005, 2006, and so on. And it has come down in 2009 and 2010. But it's too early to say if that is a permanent structural increase, Asia is rebalancing automatically, or whether it's merely cyclical. As global demand for Asian exports has collapsed, Asia's current account surplus has narrowed, but unless the underlying structure of the economy changes, once the global economy recovers, the surplus will just come back. We're not there yet. I think all we have seen is that there has been some narrowing of the surplus. For what it's worth, our economic outlook, the one last October and the one before that in April, actually expect that once the global recovery is well established, the surpluses will grow again, and we'll basically be back to the world where we were before when the external surplus is growing. The point is that Asia remains highly dependent on external demand. Asia's dependence on external demand, I think we all understand, so there's no need to document that too much. I would just say that, first of all, the contribution of net exports to growth in Asia, which is the orange bar on the right-hand panel, is quite high, and it's higher than other emerging market regions like Latin America. And if one takes into account that net exports is one concept, but net exports is exports minus imports, another way to look at how dependent a region is on external demand is to look at value added that's actually produced in the economy using inputs also from your own economy. And if you do that, then in the left-hand panel, we basically see that Asian economy's share of value added that's linked to external demand is also very high by international standards. Moreover, about two-thirds of export value added goes to destinations outside of Asia, particularly the United States and Europe. So Asia is still very dependent on external demand. Moreover, the exposure to external demand is particularly concentrated in highly cyclical exports. For example, high-tech and medium-tech goods like IT products, autos and auto parts, and pharmaceuticals. That's basically the share of medium and high-tech goods that's in the left panel in orange. The implication of such a high reliance on highly cyclical products is when there are shocks in the global economy, the impact on Asia tends to be magnified. Because the Asian exports react more than proportionately to the global cycle because they are concentrated in these cyclical products. For example, between mid-2008 and mid-2009, during the depth of the global downturn, the drop in U.S. imports from Asia was at 10 times the pace of the fall in U.S. consumption. So Asia is not only highly exposed to global demand, but it's actually exposed to the particularly volatile components of global demand. Moreover, the true role of exports and external demand in Asia is higher than simply the export and the balance of payments data suggests. The reason is that a lot of investment is investment in industries that produce for export. A lot of consumption is consumption that is based on wages that workers earn who work in factories that produce for export. So even these high numbers actually understate Asia's true reliance on exports. Chapter one of the book, Olaf and Papa are both here, chapter one of the book actually goes into this dependence in more detail, and it asks quantitatively the question, what would be the implications for Asian growth in the long term of a package of measures to rebalance growth away from exports and towards domestic demand? I think the main conclusion they reach is that there are significant benefits in terms of higher sustainable long-term growth, but that those benefits are most likely to be realized if there's a coordinated effort across Asia to rebalance growth rather than just one country making all of the effort. Okay, so Asia is highly dependent on external demand. In order to reduce this external dependence, it needs a second engine of growth. What should that second engine of growth be? Obviously, it should be domestic demand, and in particular, domestic private demand. Now, domestic private demand comprises two components, consumption and investment. And here, the story starts to diverge across countries. In some countries, like China, consumption is low relative to GDP, only around 36%. That's the leftmost bar on the left-hand panel. In China, as I said, but also in the NIEs and in Japan, there's a need also to rebalance investment away from the tradable sector to the non-tradable sector. This challenge of rebalancing investment away from traded to non-traded goods, I think we treat relatively lightly in the book. I think it's covered elsewhere in the literature. I should have made clear in the beginning that, you know, this is not the definitive book that covers all aspects of rebalancing. We just pick out a few things that we think we can focus on. It's not something that we dwell much on, but it is a challenge. And meanwhile, in other countries, as I said, like Philippines, Indonesia, some of the ASEAN countries, the challenge is quite different. Consumption is actually pretty high. So if you look at the left panel, which shows consumption as a share of GDP, the second one from the right, the rightmost one is the United States. The second one from the right is actually Philippines, Asian country. The challenge for some of these Asian countries in ASEAN is not so much to raise consumption, but to raise investment. So if you look at the right panel, similar, the first bar on the right panel is Philippines, where investment is only about 17 or 18% of GDP. So the challenge in that set of countries is quite different from the challenge in China. The need is to raise investment. Chapter three presents an empirical analysis to show how the relatively low investment in some Asian countries owes largely to low returns on investment, maybe having to do with the tax code and things of that nature, to volatility and uncertainty, and somewhat to our surprise, to the business climate. The business climate has actually improved over the last decade or so, but for some reason the perception in the surveys does not seem to quite reflect that reality. The analysis also shows that private investment is held down by infrastructure in many Asian countries. It's the middle panel, which basically shows that there is a big payoff to private investment in Asia, or potentially big payoff to private investment in Asia, from improving things like electricity and telephone connections, and also transportation, which we don't show here. Asia, of course, has made a lot of progress on infrastructure over the last decade or decade and a half, but it still lags behind some other emerging market regions. Investment would also be helped by deeper financial markets. In several countries, we see that the small and domestically oriented service-producing firms face tighter financing constraints and harder economic conditions than the large manufacturing export-oriented firms. That's basically what the left panel is showing. And also, the bond markets are relatively small in most Asian countries. So alternative financing, which can finance startups, small, medium enterprises, innovative firms, financing for that segment of the market is actually very small. Even in Japan, which is the most advanced of the Asian economies, in the right-hand panel, venture capital is very small compared with other advanced countries. So there's a whole segment of the financial market in Asia that remains to be developed. Deeper financial markets would also allow firms, especially smaller firms, to accumulate less corporate saving in order to finance investment. I think that's true in the rest of Asia. It's also true in China that, you know, basically the small and medium enterprises do not have a huge amount of access to bank financing. The equity market is still very small, and the bond market is also very small. So as a consequence, firms need to build up large amounts of retained earnings to finance investment. If the financial markets were to develop, then maybe there would be scope for firms to economize on corporate saving. Okay, turning now to China. China's enormous success since 1978, I think, does not need to be repeated here in all its detail. I think you all know that very well. Certainly Nick and Peter will, I'm sure, illuminate us much more. I just say that everything that I said at the beginning about Asia's success, one can sort of double that or maybe square that, and then it applies to China. For example, Asia, I said Asia's GDP doubles every 10 years. Well, China's doubles every 7 years. So in 30 years, Asia's GDP has multiplied 8 times, China's has multiplied 16 times, and so on. One can go on in terms of trade and FDI and et cetera. I won't do that. But I think the point for us for the book is that in China, for several years now, the government has had an objective of rebalancing the economy away from a heavy reliance on exports and investment towards consumption. And it has also had the objective of reorienting investment away from traded towards non-traded sectors, developing services and developing the home goods market. The point is that the need for this rebalancing in China was recognized even before the global financial crisis. So the global financial crisis made it pretty clear that the time was coming close when demand from advanced countries would no longer sustain exports to the extent that it had done in the past. But I think even before that, there was a sense that China had become very reliant on external demand compared with other regions. In chapter 4 of the book, which again Papa Hosea has done, it concludes that to sustain China's export-oriented growth model in the future would require gains in market share that are quite hard to realize. The left panel actually shows the red line is China's share in world export markets. And basically what it shows is that China's market share has already surpassed export market shares that Asia's advanced economies like Japan and Korea achieved during their export-oriented growth surges. And I should mention that the growth experience of export-oriented growth of Japan, Korea, and so on occurred in a much more conducive global environment than we have today. So I think that China's export-oriented model was already being questioned even within China. I think it's well recognized that to turn away from exports will require a whole host of reforms. In particular, the relative prices and the whole incentive structure will need to change away from providing rewards for producing tradable goods towards rewarding production of non-tradable goods. And that will require things like changes in the relative price of foreign exchange, so some exchange rate appreciation, which is an important part of the package, but only part of the package of what is needed. It will also require adjustments in other relative prices, like the cost of capital, the cost of energy, and other inputs that go largely into the production of tradable goods. Now, there's a question that is asked that basically if China, which is so reliant on exports for its... Actually, I think even that can be overhyped. Basically, China relies for around a third of its growth on exports. But again, that understates the total contribution because some of investment is export-oriented, some of consumption is export-driven. But in any case, turning away from the export-oriented growth model is seen as having negative employment implications. That's obviously a serious concern. We hadn't seen much, quantitative analysis of exactly how big the problem might be, what might be the implications for reallocation across sectors, and so on. So chapter 5, which again Papa has done, basically makes a couple of core observations. One of them is that in China, the employment in services, so services employment as a share of total employment, is actually very low compared to other countries. Now, since services tend to be labor intensive, the low share of services has actually contributed to growth in China being less employment intensive than it might have been, and that growth at similar rates has been in other countries. At the same time, the low share of employment in services also offers an opportunity. I think, as everyone who's sort of worked or lived in China knows, the Chinese character for challenge is also opportunity. So, you know, the challenge of low services employment is also an opportunity, in the sense that even small shifts of production towards services can have potentially large payoffs in terms of employment. And in fact, the paper has a simulation which shows that, or argues that, rebalancing from traded to non-traded goods, while it would entail employment losses in the short term, it would imply a net gain in jobs over the long term. The other aspect of China is of China's rebalancing problem is, of course, the low level of consumption, especially household consumption as a percent of GDP. That's shown in the orange bar on the right-hand side. It's not only low, but has actually fallen quite sharply over the last decade. In part, this reflects the declining share of household disposable income in GDP. That's the blue bar. But chapter 6 of the book also shows chapter 6 of the book shows that the decline in household consumption as share of GDP owes, about a third of it owes to declining household income as a share of GDP, and the remainder owes to high household savings rate. The high household savings rate owes in turn to precautionary saving to a large extent. Precautionary saving because the healthcare system, the pension system, and education all require substantial amounts of saving from people, given that the public provision of these services has some gaps. Then I think some of the other chapters in the book basically go into that in some more detail and show that some improvements in social services, especially health and pensions, could significantly reduce private saving, especially among urban households. I think I've actually taken a lot of time. I was going to go on and talk a bit about the global imbalances and things like that, but maybe I'll just leave it here so that the panelists can speak. Thank you. Thank you very much. Should I go down?
Thank you.
I should go there?
No, you stay here.
Thank you, Vivek, for a very well-organized, clearly stated, and significant presentation of the findings of the study. I'm eager to hear the comments now of our colleagues here in Washington who have been longtime observers of these issues as well. If I may, I'd like to turn first to Nick Lardy and ask him for his comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug, and thank Vivek and the IMF for producing this book. I think I'm going to focus my remarks primarily on things that the book does not cover. You're all going to rush out and buy the book and read it and commit it to memory. So I would say I think it's very good in two respects. Number one, it does put the China imbalances in an Asian context, so we can see how there are some similarities and some differences, as Vivek has said. And I think the second main contribution of the book is it does provide some pretty strong empirical support for much of what I would call the conventional wisdom on what needs to be done on rebalancing, like rebuilding a social safety net, for example. What I want to talk about is primarily some questions that I think are critical that I think the book does not address or does not address adequately.
And first of these would be, are these numbers that we saw on consumption really reliable? Is China's consumption share of GDP as low as the official numbers suggest? Is 35% really plausible? I went back and looked at the U.S. data. The lowest consumption share in the U.S. ever was 1942. When we had no production of consumer durables at all, everything was, you know, all the auto factories were making tanks and aircraft and other stuff. Even most consumer goods were rationed. And the consumption share of GDP was, and there was forced savings on a massive scale from the sale of war bonds, which absorbed and raised the savings rate quite substantially in the household sector. Consumption was 50% of GDP. So China's 35%. I still can't square this, and I do think that China's GDP expenditure data probably underestimate the provision of housing services. We've seen a huge boom in housing in the last period, but on the official data, the share of GDP expenditure that's coming from household services has declined by half a percentage point. It's gone from 6.6 to 6.1. I don't understand how that could have happened. If you look at India, housing services are roughly 8 to 9% of GDP. I can't understand why China would be below the Indian level. So maybe there's a few percentage points that are missing here and there. So maybe the situation's not quite as bad as the diagram suggests. But there's no addressing of this question. The official data are just accepted at face value with no discussion. Now, the second question that I think doesn't really get adequately addressed is the question of why the labor share of national income has declined. Vivek mentioned this, and we know what the data show, but I think the deeper question is why has labor productivity growth outstripped wage growth for such a sustained period and by such a significant amount? We don't. The chapters don't really go into that. Is it because of labor market liberalization, the liberalization of the hukou system, and the development of a very large pool of migrant laborers, which have held down the growth of wages below what might have otherwise occurred, or is it the factor market distortions that have led to a relatively low share of services in GDP, and as Vivek also pointed out, a relatively low share of services employment? So, if we had had growth with fewer factor market distortions, maybe we could have grown just as rapidly if the structure of demand would have been different. We would have had more employment growth, and the wage share of GDP would have been higher. I'm not sure. But the policy approach you're going to take this depends on what the causation is. And this is also a general worldwide phenomenon. The wage share of GDP has gone down over the last decade, so China's not unique in this respect. The third area where I wish the book had done some analysis, there's absolutely no analysis of the government's direct role in the emerging savings investment imbalance. If we take, in other words, we want to, the difference between nationally between savings and investment is the external position, and we want to look at the savings investment balance in the household sector, in the corporate sector, and in the government sector. If we use the new flow of funds data that have come out and compare the average numbers for 2007 and 8, which are the most recent ones, with the five-year average 1998-90 through 2002, that's comparing a period in which China had a huge external surplus and a period in which they had a very, very modest external surplus, 1 to 2% of GDP, 1998 through 2002. In that period, 2007-08 versus this base year period, the net saving investment imbalance rose by 8.4 percentage points. The savings investment imbalance in the household sector did go up by about 3.7 percentage points, mostly because savings went up more than investment. The savings investment imbalance of the corporate sector, despite all the talk we read about corporate savings, yes, the savings did go up in the corporate sector, but their investment also went up quite a bit. So the savings investment imbalance in the corporate sector only rose by 1.2%. The savings investment imbalance in the government sector rose by 3.4 percentage points. So the increase in savings investment imbalance in the government sector is almost as big, within a couple of tenths of a percentage point, almost as big as in the household sector. But there's not a word about that in this book. Why is it the case that the government has made such an immense contribution to the savings investment imbalance, and what's the policy implication? We talk about rebuilding a social safety net and doing this and doing that, but maybe there should be a set of policies. It would seem it would be a lot easier to change the government saving investment imbalance than it would be to induce households to somehow consume more. Anyway, in short, the government directly contributed a very, very substantial share of the increase in savings investment imbalance. We have dozens and dozens of articles looking at household savings. We have dozens and dozens of articles in the literature looking at what's been going on in the corporate sector in terms of their savings and investment. But there's not much on what's happening in the government sector, and I think it would have been very helpful if the book had taken a look at that, subject. The fourth area where I think there should have been more analysis, implicitly there's a teeny bit of this, but the whole question of how financial repression has been a factor in the imbalances. The book does mention that household interest income has declined over time as a share of GDP, but it doesn't point out that this occurred in a period when the stock of household savings relative to GDP has gone up a great deal. And it doesn't also point out that since 2003, we have a highly repressed financial system. And this coincides precisely with the emergence of the undervalued exchange rate. If we take as our indicator of financial repression, we want to look at the real interest rate. We're going to look at this from the point of view of savers and take the one-year deposit rate and subtract off the CPI. And in the period 97 through 2003, the real return to savings in the form of a one-year CD was 3.0%. From 2004 through 2010, the next seven-year period, the real return was negative 0.5%. So there's a massive discontinuity. Savings was reasonably rewarded in the earlier period, and now savings is being taxed. I don't think it's an accident this financial repression emerged as China's exchange rate became increasingly undervalued. The central bank has the contradictory goals of maintaining price stability and also keeping the exchange rate undervalued, and they have kept interest rates low in order to make the financing of the sterilization campaign that's necessary to keep price stability more modest. In other words, higher interest rates would be massively expensive for the central bank. I think China is the best example ever of Barry Eichengreen's comment that everywhere you look, countries that have undervalued exchange rates have to have relatively low interest rates, and China is certainly an example. Higher interest rates have put the central bank into a massive money-losing situation, as it had to pay higher interest on required reserves and on the bills that it issues to sterilize the increase in the domestic money supply. And this is also the period when the household savings rate went up. Why did the household savings rate went up? The book puts a lot of emphasis on the no social safety net. Well, the dismantling of the social safety net actually occurred in the 90s when Zhu Rongji downsized the state-owned sector, and the savings rate didn't go up very much. The savings rate of households went up in the period of financial repression because the return to financial savings went down, and households with these target goals for savings for the precautionary purposes that Vivek mentioned had to save more in order to offset the decline in the real return to their savings. So I think financial repression is a big part of the story about the imbalances that emerge, and it's not really more than barely mentioned. I have one more subject on my list, and that is there's no analysis of the various theories that suggest the Chinese economy is going to rebalance automatically. In other words, a lot of people say, yes, they got into these difficulties, looks very imbalanced, but just wait a while, it's all going to go away. And the prime candidate in this respect, of course, is wages. People are arguing that there's been a fundamental change, that we're in the Lewis turning point or turning period, and that real wages are now starting to go up much more rapidly, and that is going to lead to a real appreciation of the exchange rate, even if the nominal rate doesn't change very much, and that the result is that we will have a decline in the external surplus, we'll have an increase in the wage share of GDP, we'll have an increase in consumption as a share of GDP, and if you just put on your seatbelt and not worry so much about the situation today, that all will be well in due course and the government doesn't have to do very much. I think it's worth looking at that because it could be true, or it could certainly contribute. I'm a skeptic because if you look at what's been happening over the last 5 years, since China adopted its more flexible exchange rate policy, wages have gone up on average in the formal sector by more than 12% per year, and in the informal sector by about 6% per year, maybe a little bit more. So these are very, very fast rates of growth of real wages. But if we look at the prices of Chinese goods imported into the United States, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, by the end of last year, the prices of goods imported into the United States from China, despite this huge increase in wages, a 20% real appreciation of the currency, the prices of Chinese goods coming into the United States are only 2% more expensive than they were in June of 2005. My view is this: we have massive labor productivity growth in China, particularly in the tradable goods sector, and it will take a very large increase in the weight of wage inflation to change the situation that we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years, when basically there's been very high wage growth, but unit labor costs have not really increased. But maybe wages are accelerating more rapidly than the figures that I just quoted, and maybe the next 5 years will be very different. But again, that is on my list of things that the book did not take up. I just want to comment on one more area about there are some areas where things are developing so fast in China that the book seems somewhat out of date, and lending to the household sector is certainly one of those. One of the closing chapters looks at the question of whether or not couldn't we get more consumption in China if we had a deeper financial system and there was more household credit? Well, you might ask, you know, households have 30 trillion RMB in the bank. They could spend it anytime they want. It's not clear they need a lot more credit. But if you look at what's actually been happening, the share of bank loans going to the household sector has risen dramatically over the last 3 years. It was 14% in 2008, 26% in 2009, and 36% last year. So the flow of lending relative to GDP has gone up substantially in that period. So household borrowing has gone from 700 billion in 2008 to 2.9 trillion last year. In other words, the increase in household borrowing has quadrupled over a two-year period. And the availability of consumer credit, including mortgages, has been very substantially increased. The book suggests that China has a less developed mortgage market than other countries, but mortgage loans outstanding to households have gone in this period were about 3 trillion in, or 10% of GDP in 2008 to 6.2 trillion last year, 15% of GDP. So mortgage loans outstanding to individuals in China now are substantially higher than a number of other Asian countries at comparable or even higher levels of economic and financial development than in China. So the suggestion in the book that China has a smaller individual mortgage market than would be expected based on a number of economic and financial variables, I think, quite frankly, by now is very out of date. The mortgage market has doubled in a two-year period. There's a huge increase in credit to households. And so this is an area where change in China has been so rapid that the book is already out of date. So an excellent collection of papers. Lots of the conventional issues are looked at. Good empirical data provided on what I call some of the conventional arguments about the policies that need to be adopted for rebalancing, but doesn't look at a range of issues that I think are central to understanding the causes of the imbalances and the policies that are most likely to be effective in addressing these imbalances going forward. Why the labor share of national income has fallen by about 5 percentage points over the last decade. Why is the direct contribution of the government to the imbalance, particularly the external imbalance, so large, almost as big as the household sector? And why has the government been pursuing a policy of financial repression since 2003, 2004? What's the implications of that for rebalancing?
That's terrific, Nick. Thank you very, very much. Peter Beautellier, thank you.
Thank you, Doug. We didn't rehearse anything beforehand, but some of my comments are remarkably similar to Nick's, and I think in some ways supplement his comments. I was very intrigued by your penultimate point that perhaps we don't have to worry so much about the rebalancing questions for China, that things will come all right by themselves. That's, in fact, one of the key points I want to make. But before I do so, I share Nick's very positive assessment of the value of this publication. It's excellent, very timely, and full of substance. if I have any criticism, it's really on the margin. I think it's a very welcome contribution to the debate on these global issues. I like the China chapters best, actually. But the first three chapters are also good, but for different reasons. I think they're full of meat, but they suffer from the aggregation problem. It's very, very hard to aggregate economic data for Asia as a whole in a meaningful way. A very clear illustration, I think, is a footnote in the third chapter, which says, innocently at the bottom of page 50, for the rest of this discussion, we exclude India and China from the discussion, not pointing out that India and China together account for more than half of Asia's GDP, even if you include Japan. So to some extent, the book itself is unbalanced. It might have been better to devote the first three chapters to just Japan and the NIEs, and the last four chapters to China. That would have perhaps a more logical balance. I share Nick's concern that although the book is very good at pointing out what happened, it doesn't always try to explain why things happened. And it points out correctly that this problem of these global imbalances really began to emerge only around 2003, not so long ago. Before that, nobody really worried too much about it. What happened that brought about this fairly sudden explosion of net exports, net current account surpluses in China and some other Asian countries? Was that China's exchange rate policy? Well, it's hard to argue that because they didn't change anything. So what else was going on that drove these imbalances from around 2003 onward? And that's my first point that I would have liked to see more coverage on in the book. The global imbalances really are centered on the United States and China. These are the two epicenters of the global imbalances. Not the only ones, but the epicenters. What happened in China? The main factors, in my opinion, that caused China's external surpluses to suddenly go off the charts had nothing to do with the exchange rate, certainly not initially. It's mainly due to the very aggressive enterprise reforms and financial sector reforms that were introduced in the late 70s by Zhu Rongji in response to the Asian financial crisis, which... In the late 90s. That was combined, the effect of that on productivity growth in manufacturing in particular was combined with a number of one-off factors such as the privatization of urban housing in China, which reinforced the liquidity position of the corporate sector enormously and allowed them to invest. That combined with the very sharp productivity growth in manufacturing allowed China to gain global market share without showing significant domestic excess capacity, as otherwise would have been the case. On the American side, I think we see almost the exact opposite. We see an explosion in demand, which nicely sort of supplemented or complemented the explosion on supply on the Chinese side. The explosion in demand on the American side we know the Bush tax cuts, which caused the federal fiscal balances to turn around by $500 to $600 billion in the space of a few years. The second important factor was extremely loose Fed monetary policies, but perhaps the most powerful factor was the uncontrolled credit expansion due to the securitization and all the bad things that were happening in the housing market and in the American financial system. That caused demand in the United States to explode, which caused import demand to explode, which caused China to be able to very nicely offload all their surplus supply on the United States. So the imbalances that really took off from that time have causes that we haven't always focused on correctly. It has nothing to do with the exchange rate. The exchange rate only became a contributing factor from then on. Let me skip a number of points that I wanted to make. I can circulate my notes earlier. Chapter 5, and I think more generally other chapters on China as well, in my opinion, although very good, by and large, overemphasize or make too much of the relative underconsumption in China. It is true that the consumption GDP ratio is extraordinarily low, even though I admit with Nick's comments in mind that we don't fully understand that 36% number, which seems very low. But that's not the real issue. I mean, consumption GDP ratio is a fraction. We can either focus on the numerator or on the denominator. Typically, journalists and many analysts have focused on the nominator. That is, how can we get China's private consumption growth rate to grow even faster? I preferred focus on the denominator, quite frankly, because China's growth became unbalanced because they were investing too much and GDP growth was too high. If we can keep China's consumption growth rate at the 8.9% where it has been in the last decade, we are fine. We don't have to worry about that. We have to try and rebalance China's economy by changing, by reducing A, the overall investment rate, and particularly the tradable part of the investment rate. And I think I fully agree with Vivek on that point. But that's an important point, a distinction to make. Consumption growth in China is not the problem. It might be been by far the fastest growing consumer market in the world by a huge margin, two or three times as fast as the fastest consumption growth in the Western countries. So that's not the issue. We should really focus at the denominator of the equation. One small comment I'd like to make on Chapter 8, although I have no basic quarrels with the analysis, I don't share the enthusiasm of the authors of that chapter for payroll loans as an instrument to promote Chinese household consumption. I think we have seen in this country and in Korea and some other countries the very dangerous negative effects of excessive reliance on credit to promote consumption growth, particularly payroll loans. I don't like, so it's a bit of a point that I'd like to emphasize. Now let me come to the point that I made initially, why I think there are reasons to think that perhaps this whole unbalanced Chinese economy will rectify itself more or less by itself, regardless of what Beijing does or does not do. I would even go beyond that. I would say it's not too late to begin to think about the possibility that China's excessively large external surpluses will turn around and that China will become a net capital importer in the next 10, 15 years. We haven't focused on that because we take it for granted that these large surplus savers like China will always be large surplus savers. I don't think that we can take that for granted. Should the Chinese savings investment balance turn around to the point where China becomes a net capital importer, everything will totally change. World capital markets will not be comparable to what they are at present. And the cost of capital globally will be much, much higher than we would dare to predict, than we would predict on the basis of current international circumstances. But having said that, let me focus on seven reasons why I think the dynamics at work in China and the rest of the world will push towards greater balances, not greater imbalances. First factor is we should remember that the tremendous high savings rate in China, both the corporate savings rate and the private savings rate, and in fact the government savings rate, from around the turn of the century onward, was to some extent due to one-off factors that will not be repeated. People have not systematically taken into account the enormous effects of the urban housing privatization in China. That has created so much liquidity in the corporate sector. It suddenly meant that enterprises that owned the almost entire housing stock in urban China no longer had to spend a penny on maintaining it or on constructing new housing. The entire responsibility for urban housing was privatized in China. The effects of that on corporate liquidity, on government liquidity, and I think indirectly on private savings, because the ownership of the houses was transferred at a fraction of real market values, has not been systematically analyzed. That's a one-off factor that will not recur. My second reason is that the availability of consumer finance, as Nick also pointed out, including in particular mortgage finance, has already exploded in recent years. And that will lift consumption growth rate beyond what we would otherwise predict. Third reason, and that's based on the analysis by Steve Barnett and Ray Brooks in Chapter 8, which I liked very much, is that they point to a very positive correlation between government spending on health and the reduction in the need for precautionary savings, in other words, the increase in household consumption. That's a very powerful factor, particularly now if you look at the budget plans that were submitted over the weekend and the five-year plan, you see very aggressive government plans to increase the share of budget spending for the social sectors, in particular health and education. So that dynamic will very much push in the direction we want to happen. The next reason is that although I agree that the share of services in China's GDP has lagged and is lower than it should be. If you look at the employment numbers in the last few years, you see that the employment growth in the service sectors in China has already been much faster than the employment growth in the manufacturing sector. And that's likely to accelerate. What's the significance? The significance is that the level of education and income of workers in the service sector is on average much higher than in the manufacturing sector. So to the extent that structural adjustment in the Chinese economy will continue and intensify, we can be pretty sure that the share of household income, household disposable income in GDP will stop falling and possibly even increase. It will happen by itself. Next reason, well, that's more of a, sort of a point of fact. If you look at the current account surpluses, as Vivek also pointed out, the surplus has already come down quite a lot. It was almost 11% in China's case, current account surplus as a percentage of GDP in 2007. It came down to about 9% in 2008, then to 6% in 2009. Now we are waiting for the final accounts for 2010. My concern is that the decline may not have continued in 2010, that we may see an uptick again in the share of the current account surplus or as a percentage of GDP. But I don't see that as the beginning of a new trend. I think the trend will continue to go down. If you look at the trade balance, it's quite striking that almost everybody now expects China's trade surplus to be negative in the first quarter of this year, and the overall trade surplus for, which is the largest part of the current account surplus, the overall trade surplus for 2011 will probably be considerably lower than in 2010. Then I go to perhaps what is the most powerful point, and that is the nominal exchange rate. Whilst I agree with Nick and others that China has been too timid in adjusting the nominal exchange rate, what has happened as a result of this larger inflationary pressure in China that we're now observing, and in some other Asian countries as well, in fact, India is much worse than China, is that the real exchange rate has begun to run away from the nominal exchange rate quite appreciably. Secretary Geithner, in a recent presentation at SAIS across the street, drew the attention of the audience to the fact that by his calculations, China's real exchange rate, that is the nominal rate compensated for by differential inflation between China and the US, that the nominal renminbi, the real renminbi dollar, US dollar exchange rate was appreciating annualized at least 10% now. That if that's the situation for only 2 years, we're home and dry, then undervaluation may become a thing of the past, and that could happen sooner. Now, I agree that we don't know how fast productivity growth is in manufacturing, so we don't know to which extent very fast productivity growth in manufacturing can compensate for increased production costs in the manufacturing China. In China, but I think that the period of maximum productivity growth is behind us. That was the period 1999-2005. After that, productivity growth remained high, but will not accelerate again. It will gradually come down. So the effect of real exchange rate appreciation will have a real bite, I think, on the margins in a lot of export-oriented manufacturing. And I think that will be a very powerful factor pushing for the kind of structural reforms that we all believe that are necessary. Finally, let me point to a somewhat harder to understand factor. And I think Wangqi would be able to amplify my point here because he's done a lot of analytical work. If you look at China's trade balance, the surplus is due entirely to the processing part of China's trade. If you look at the regular part of China's trade, there is no surplus. Now, what is happening, partly as a result of exchange rate pressures, but also as a result of deliberate government policy that is promoting the share of domestic value added in manufacturing and export industries generally, partly by promoting domestic indigenous innovation, you will see, my guess is that over time, the share of the processing trade in China's total exports will go down. and that almost automatically will lead to a reduction in China's trade surplus. So these are seven reasons why I believe that, as Nick already hinted, perhaps we don't have to worry too much. Let things happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, and Nick for taking on quite strongly the conventional wisdom and some of the findings in this story. Now, we have been discussing tiger economies, but this audience has got more tigers in it. And Vivek has agreed to pass on his comments on the comments and get right to your questions. So we can start over here. We have microphones. Please introduce yourself, Richard Doge. And
good morning, Doug. I have a question on inflation.
Could you identify yourself and your institution?
I will do that right away.
Thanks.
Richard Doge, professor of economics at SAIS. We have a great deal of faith in our own national accounts, and in particular, its estimation of inflation from time to time. And that, of course, moves into the deflator by which we get our real GDP. I'm not sure that we have an equivalent amount of faith in the data dissembled, the statistics behind inflation and deflators in China. Therefore, I'm not quite sure that we have a good handle on the GDP growth in China. Would you give us some indication as to your faith in the data that has been used in this book and that data used even if it is derived from non-Chinese figures, for example, the World Bank and the IMF? What's your level of faith in the deflation and the deflator? Thank you.
Can you direct that question to anyone in particular?
I think we have a great panel, and either Peter or Nick would be competent to answer it. Thank you.
Well, you already heard me say I think some of Chinese data is not perfect. I'm a little suspicious of their effort to measure housing services, but, you know, that's fairly complicated, imputed value of owner-occupied housing and all these other things. It's not so easy to do, so they could be off by a few percentage points. And the same thing could probably be said for most of the other data. However, I don't think their price data is that bad. I mean, if we look at the GDP deflators, the last time I did this, Bert Keidel could comment on this. It looks to me like the GDP deflator in most year looks like a weighted average or some kind of average of the CPI and the PPI, which, you know, it doesn't sound like a bad starting point. In other words, the deflator is not over here in a completely different world than the deflator is not published. You have to calculate it. It's an implicit deflator. It's not completely unrelated to the other price indices that are published. A lot of people think the consumer price understates real inflation. That's asserted repeatedly, but in the recent period, for example, most of the inflation was coming in food, and food is overweighted in the index. Now they rebase the index every 5 years. They've lowered the share going to food by, I can't remember, 3 or 4 percentage points. So presumably if they had used that basis for calculating the CPI last year, they would have gotten a slightly lower number than the 3.3% official figure for year-over-year inflation. So I guess my short answer is not perfect, but probably better than most other emerging markets in terms of the quality of the national income and related data.
I have very little to add to that. I think there are certain problems, but I don't think there's any systematic, deliberate falsification of databases in China. The whole statistical data collection system is a work in progress. They had two major transitions to make. One was to go from the old Russian material balances system of national accounts to a value-added system of national accounts. That's a huge, difficult administrative change. And secondly, the data collection system had to go from a state-based data collection to a non-state plus non-state sector collection, data collection system. That's a work in progress. I mean, the whole data collection system that they set up in the 80s and the 90s is no longer useful today. One of the illustrations of that is the undercounting of the contribution of housing to GDP, because services were not considered a value-added sector in the old Russian style of national accounts. More specifically, the CPI inflation, which has been the subject of a lot of criticism in China, you should know that the MBS just recently, in the last few months, has changed the weights for the calculation of the CPI. They've brought down the food component in the CPI, and as, because the most inflation was food price inflation, that tended to reduce the overall CPI inflation, which caused some people to be very suspicious of the motivations behind this. But I think the adjustment of the weights in the CPI was, if anything, overdue, quite frankly. I think the MBS is a serious professional institution and getting better all the time. The worst components of the what they publish, I think, are the employment statistics and the housing statistics, the housing value-added statistics. But the financial statistics have become very much better in China and are superior to most developing countries, and also more timely than most countries. China produces national accounts for the preceding months within 2 weeks of the next month. There are almost no countries doing that. So I don't think that we should look at the Chinese statistics as deliberately mismanaged. It's still a working in progress with problems.
Yeah, I think I'd largely agree with that. I mean, I think there are two levels that with that question can be asked. One is, you know, do you believe every last number down to the last decimal point? Obviously not. I mean, there's measurement issues, classification issues, and things of that nature. But I think from the point of view of research that we do in the book, the main thing that we focus on is the trends. And the two things we basically look at are the trends over time, and secondly, the consistency of data across sectors. And so, you know, I think while inflation may be a little bit higher or lower, GDP growth, some people 10 years ago were saying it was overstated. 5 years ago, they suddenly said it was understated based on looking at provincial data or deflation and so on. I'm not sure about the exact level, but I think the trend of, you know, China being basically a high growth, low non-fluid inflation economy, which is highly reliant on exports, I don't think that's going to change based on how you configure the data. For example, I mean, I think the comment was made about China's consumption share in GDP being so low. I mean, how can people live if they only consume 36% of income? And the U.S., first of all, U.S. is very different from China. I'm not sure that the structural features of the economies are that similar that one can sort of line up U.S. experience and, you know, expect China to follow it exactly. But more importantly, it's the trend that matters, that consumption as a share of GDP used to be 55%, which I think we would have said was, you know, borderline normal. It's now 35. Maybe it's not really 35. Maybe it's a higher number. The point is that the trend has been very sharply downward. So I think, again, I don't think that I'd put a lot of capital on each single data point, but I think it's more an analysis of the trend and looking at the data across sectors. I don't think the basic picture will change from what we've painted in the book.
In the middle back here, Bert Keidel.
Thank you very much. This is a very interesting book. I got one library copy a few days ago. And I agree on the data issue. I wanted to ask you, Vivek, what you personally have found convincing about some of the conclusions in the book. The first is that China has been heavily reliant on the external sector for its growth. I think there's a great deal of agreement among China economists that before 2005, this clearly was not the case. And after 2005, it's controversial because the expansion in demand was so great and China had to cool off its economy, and its growth grew to 14%, that the external demand overheated the economy. So what really has convinced you that it's export-led? Because there's sort of guilt by association. The book is about Asia. And yet, as Peter's pointed out, you sort of disassociate China from it in a footnote for a while, for most of the analysis. And in fact, these other countries do have export-led growth, heavily correlated with U.S. growth patterns, and China's negatively correlated. So what has convinced you, A, that it's has been export-led, B, that it has caused the imbalances? I think Peter's point about the growth of U.S. unregulated credit forcing imbalances on China is a more likely explanation. And three, in consumption share in GDP, Peter's point is Exactly right. Consumption is growing very fast because the whole economy is growing very fast, and that has something to do with a high rate of investment. So you kind of got a sort of a causal quandary here, that if you lower consumption, you may get a little boost for a while, and my data show that it lasts, 6 or 7 years, but after that, your consumption levels are actually lower, and the total GDP was actually 10 percentage points larger when China had a surplus that was that big, or 11%. So that took away from the GDP share that could be attributed to consumption. So there are three questions there. What's convinced you that these concluding generalizations in the book actually represent what's happened in terms of data? Thank you.
Okay. I think first of all on the consumption share of GDP, it's true that it's a ratio. So there are two ways to reduce it. One is to boost consumption. The other is to actually lower GDP growth. I think we took as the starting point of the analysis that the authorities actually pay a lot of attention to GDP growth and that their policy objective is to sustain high growth because high growth delivers or should deliver high employment. So I think to start by saying that, you should actually consider a path where the first thing is to lower GDP growth. Maybe one can discuss it in an academic sense. I'm not sure it's a practical kind of starting point for the discussion. In any case, I think that the focus on boosting income and therefore boosting consumption, it's partly sort of from the macroeconomic side. It's partly, I think, in China also a social focus, that many of the things that need to be done which will help rebalancing are also things that would have been helpful in any case. For example, to boost healthcare among the rural population, to boost pensions in an environment where the demographics are going to go very sharply against sort of the working age population, to boost education. These things are social objectives as well. So I think the focus on boosting consumption, which we actually see as the authorities' focus, we think is a correct focus. So I think the starting point on boosting consumption, we didn't see as a particularly kind of controversial one. Maybe it is. In terms of export-led, I think I partly agree and partly disagree. What is true, as I said, I thought I said in my presentation, was that there were no large imbalances in Asia through the 80s and the 90s. So, China did export a lot, but the current account balance was not that large. The outward orientation is a different thing from an imbalance. So, since 1978, China did literally follow reform and opening up, where the opening up did involve greater participation of foreign firms, foreign investment, and exports, but the economy also grew very rapidly. So the exports were not reflected in a big current account surplus. Something changed in around 2000, not five, but 2003. What changed in 2003 was, I think first of all that the exchange rate of the renminbi was relatively flat against the US dollar. As the US dollar started to weaken, then the renminbi also weakened in effective terms and became undervalued. I think that the reforms of the state enterprises in the late 1990s, the breaking of the so-called iron rice bowl, where until then, if you were a state enterprise worker, you would get pensions, healthcare, everything from the enterprise. That changed in 1998. 30 million people were unemployed and had to find new employment without all these benefits. That, I think it's a sort of facile suggestion that you should expect that to immediately have an impact on people's behavior. It happens over time. People who were working in 1998, 97, who retired in the early 90s, suddenly found themselves with a very different social insurance safety net than before. And other factors also happened, in the global economy. So I think it was a combination of factors, but it's quite easy to see that about seven, eight years ago was a kind of turning point in the experience.
Doug, can I come in on this point?
Yeah, please.
I'd like to just come in on this point and support Vivek and disagree with Peter that the exchange rate had nothing to do with it. I agree that there were
No.
The facts of the matter are that China pegged to the dollar in the mid-90s. The dollar appreciated for seven consecutive years. China's trade-weighted real exchange rate up until February of 2002 was appreciating by about 3.5% per year. Then, as Vivek said, the dollar started to go down, and they were tied to the dollar, so the RMB was depreciating consistently. Now, we know that the exchange rate affects the trade balance with a lag of a year or two. So the big imbalances that emerged beginning in 2003 and more apparent in 2004 were a function of the fact that by that time, China's real exchange rate had been depreciating significantly for a period of 2 years. And not only had it depreciated compared to where it was in February 2002, if you take it against the trend line, which if they'd continued to appreciate at 3.5%, which is what they needed to keep their current account in the 1% to 2% range, they were massively undervalued. So sure, some domestic factors contributed, but the argument that initially the exchange rate had nothing to do with it, I do not accept, because they've been depreciating substantially for 2 to 3 years by the time the big imbalances emerged, and they depreciated even more against the trend of what they need to do to keep a real equilibrium exchange rate.
In the fifth row, Warren Dadush.
Yes, we Dadush with the Carnegie Endowment. Thank you very much, Doug, for organizing a terrific panel, terrific discussion. Just wanted to clarify one point and then comment. Do I have it right that the current account surplus in Asia in 2009-2010 was around 1%, 1.5% of GDP?
Including China?
Including Asia, all of Asia. 1% of GDP?
Around 1, yeah.
Of so which what's the issue? What is the issue?
Sorry, it's percent of global GDP, not Asian GDP.
1% of global GDP. Yeah. Okay. My point is, so what? I mean, 1% of global GDP is a small number, as far as I'm concerned, if we're talking about global imbalances. And I guess really it's a fairly fundamental point about the whole nature of the discussion. 1% of global GDP against a background where Asia itself has been growing spectacularly on a sustained basis for many years, and where Asia contributed in a fundamental way to stabilizing the global economy during the recession in 2009, does not strike one as the most important problem that we are confronting. So there's a sense of unreality about this whole discussion, to be honest. And insofar as the issue is bilateral imbalances between China and the United States, I think that's an interesting question to spend time on. However, let me just underscore what Peter Bottiglia said, that there is a superbly clear explanation as to why the imbalances in the United States became so extreme in the course of the 2000s. You know, the tax cuts, the increased spending, war spending, et cetera, needed as it was, and the very, very low policy interest rates and the credit expansion and explosion, which actually was a fundamental cause of the financial crisis in the first place. It's not clear to me just how much Asia was contributing to the problem.
Okay, I think on that I would just say that the focus on imbalances or on rebalancing growth is not, from our point of view, primarily about either saying that Asia contributed significantly to global imbalances, nor that Asia needs to rebalance to substantially reduce global imbalances. I think that rebalancing by Asia, I mean, if there's a global imbalance, then reduction in current account surpluses will make a contribution by definition. But where we are coming from is not that Asia needs to rebalance in order to help kind of, you know, the global imbalance. I think it'll have that effect, but that's not the primary motivation. The primary motivation is that within Asia, the export-oriented growth model may start to face some natural limits if the demand for its imports, of Asia's exports from the rest of the world, is diminished. And post-global financial crisis, our sense is that the appetite and ability of consumers in the United States and Europe to continue to demand products from Asia to the same extent that they did before the financial crisis will be lower. And if that's the case, then there is a very clear question that Asian policymakers face, that basically if exports, which were an engine of growth, have diminished force in the future, then what kind of implications do we want to see from that? There are two implications. One is accept the fact that export growth in the future will be lower, and therefore that GDP growth will be lower in the future, or try to replace the gap that is left by export growth by trying to develop domestic engines of growth. And I accept that there's sort of many views on this, but I think that the overwhelming view among Asian policymakers is to try and find a replacement for the gap that is left by lower exports. And then that's basically the context where this book comes from, that I think it's set in an environment where Asian policymakers have faced a different world environment than they faced before, and they're asking themselves how they can continue to sustain fast growth in the future. It's peripheral. I think I put this chart here just to show that there is sort of some context for the overall discussion, but in the book, it's not about kind of Asia contributing or contributing to the reduction of global imbalances. It's more about Asia rebalancing to sustain its own growth in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Aziz, APC. A wonderful panel. Thank you so much. Just to come back on that chart on consumption versus GDP, I wonder if that is really a reflection, because it's a ratio. It's a reflection of what is happening to GDP rather than consumption alone. Because it's extremely hard, just echoing the panel who's commented on that, to imagine such a dive in consumption during a period of perhaps one of the most explosive growth of that kind of scale ever imagined in human history, a 15-year period. So is it a reflection to accept the premise that the data is, in fact, not that wrong, that is fairly correct, that, in fact, the proportion of exports in GDP is a lot bigger than what you suggested? I think you said a third, maybe is much more than that, perhaps two-thirds. You know, the numbers would be just enormous. And if that's the case, then I agree with the panel, consequences of, you know, presenting a chart like that really... there's large consequences, and that explains a kind of imbalance that I don't think we've ever experienced. Which brings me to this question that, you know, those of us who have, myself included, studied economics, often measure what's measurable only. And perhaps beyond this particular chart, the one of the largest, biggest risks to China's and Asia's future growth as compared to the last 30 years would be the largest factor, the largest risk would be social factor. And if that would be something that the panel can comment that the Chinese are getting richer, poverty is less, there is in fact more income and investment and the demand for more justice and equality, that would be a social factor rather than purely measured by economics.
Okay, I'm not sure I understood the second question, but maybe somebody else can comment on the social side. But on the consumption, I'll just repeat that we're not making the claim that, you know, consumption GDP ratio is exactly 36% of GDP. that's basically what the official data show. Whether that particular point is correct or not, I'm not sure. But the point we're making is the decline, that basically a decade ago, consumption was about 55% of GDP, and it's lost about 15 to 20 percentage points over a decade. One can corroborate that by looking at other, you know, macroeconomic data. Basically, the point that maybe exports are a much larger share of GDP, one can check whether partner countries' imports from China roughly match China's exports to partner countries. If there's a huge gap there, I think then one can sort of ask whether exports are accurately measured or not. They used to be, I think, about when I first started working on China back in 1994, 95, I think the first project I was given was to figure out the US-China bilateral imbalance. It turned out in those days that trade through Hong Kong was not adequately captured in sort of the national statistics. So there was, you know, China's exports to the United States were a small fraction of United States imports from China. All of that has changed over the last sort of 15 or 20 years. I don't think that you can get a gap in the bilateral trade data that would support an argument that, you know, the export contribution to GDP is double what we have been told so far. It may be off by a little bit, but I think the burden of proof is rather to show, you know, where is the evidence that the consumption share is either huge, taking into account that there are some caveats, for example, housing services, but that the consumption share is either huge or has in fact not declined over time. I don't know on the social if somebody else wants to say something.
Did you say yes? No. We have time for one more question before we ask Vivek to make his final wrap-up comments here on the third row on the aisle, on the side.
Thank you, and thank you all for your contribution. I'm Alan Levinson, Chief Economist at T. Rowe Price. I just, in light of the spirited arguments that the current account surplus in China is going to close on its own, would you mind summarizing what's the IMF position that widening is going to resume?
Okay. Okay, so that actually was my closing remarks. So maybe I can combine the two things. Okay, and first of all, I'll just remind you, I'm speaking on behalf of the authors and myself as the editor, not kind of official fund views. But I think that we have had a discussion over the years. I think this idea that, you know, one shouldn't make too much of imbalances because they'll go away is a legitimate question. We even did a book a couple of years ago on China's growth experience that actually looked at one of the chapters was on whether we can expect the imbalances to close on their own. I think, again, as you said, spirited views on all sides, but the general conclusion was no. The view that I think comes out of the book, basically, out of the book and I would say some of my own views. One is that I think, as Nick was saying before, the exchange rate is one of the contributors to the current account surplus. Not the only contributor. It won't fix the current account surplus on its own, but it is a contributor. And as long as it remains undervalued, once global demand starts to recover, it'll make a natural contribution to the current account surplus. So in that sense, the current account surplus is little artificially low at the moment. Secondly, I think there was a comment that was also made that don't worry about it because, you know, wages are growing fast. As wages grow fast, particularly in the rural areas, people will have more income. If you're saying that, you know, the labor share of income is what's contributed to the decline in consumption, as people have more income, they'll consume more, consumption will come back, everything will be fine. Basically, I think that may be, but that's sort of in the very long run, right? And we know where we end up in the very long run. But basically, what we have seen so far in the period since the recovery started is that it's true that wage growth in China has picked up, but the trend in wage growth now is not very far out of line with the trend in wage growth in the pre-crisis period. And as I said before, I think because if one is concerned about data, one should cross-check what other elements of the data are saying. You can look at basically corporate profit margins. If, in fact, wage growth had gone up a lot, you would have expected those to be very squeezed or loss-making firms to emerge. We don't see that. Corporate profit margins are still pretty healthy. Manufactured product price inflation, you would expect that to go up if wage growth had picked up substantially. Actually, it hasn't. I mean, there is inflation, but largely food inflation. Non-food inflation, especially manufactured products, not very strong at all. And the household income as a share of GDP has not shown any signs of
increasing in the last year or so. So I'm not sure that there's evidence that, you know, while wage growth is picking up, I'm not sure that there's evidence that that will be such a big, you know, factor that it will actually overturn what we saw in the pre-crisis period in terms of the imbalances. There are also other aspects of the labor market. I think if you've, you know, been to China or talked to firms there, you'll know that there unemployment is still a major concern among college graduates. There are skill gaps that people get degrees, but then they're unable to find jobs because there's mismatch between what they've learned and what the job market demands. So I think the idea that there'll be kind of this labor shortage on the one hand, or that wage growth will rise so much that it'll cause, you know, this big change in consumption pattern, to my mind, it's a little bit far-fetched at this moment. It's true that one way in which the whole rebalancing could be forced is through inflation, somehow. I mean, I think I have my doubts about whether non-food inflation can pick up that much, given that there is still a large excess capacity of tradable goods, which, you know, holds non-food prices down. But if there were to be a big burst of inflation for a sustained period of time, sure, that could cause the real exchange rate to appreciate, and then the real appreciation would have an implication for the trade balance. But I think our view would be that a better, sort of more positive way to get there would be through some, a combination of some nominal appreciation and adjustment of other prices, rather than just a huge inflation that forces a real exchange rate adjustment and current account adjustment. I should just say that I really wanted to thank Nick and Peter. I think the comments were very well taken and very thoughtful. The book is, as I said, we tried to cover what we thought we could have something sensible to comment on. So we were a little bit selective in what we picked up. We didn't pick up this question of automatic rebalancing because we've considered it before and didn't actually think it had much merit. There are other things like the role of financial repression that Nick mentioned, the role of the government. I think those are things we can continue to work on in the future. It's not sort of final word on the subject, but I think the last sentence in the introduction is that we hope that it adds to the vibrant discussion about rebalancing in Asia that is underway. Thank you.
I just want to say one thing in response to the last question about whether or not the imbalances are going to get bigger, and I want to support Vivek. The Chinese have already released their balance of payments data preliminary for 2010, and the current account is up 25%. Now, when they put out the final data, we'll get more disaggregation. Some of the components may change a little bit, so the final number could change slightly. But at least there's no doubt for 2010, the current account has had a gigantic increase. As Vivek said, as global demand recovers, you still have an undervalued exchange rate, the imbalances are going to reemerge.
Thank you. Listening to this wonderful and spirited discussion has really been very stimulating for me, and I think for all of you. I would just note at this point, you know, we are having a fairly dry conversation about trends and numbers and consumption rebalancing and the like. And yet in China, the government seems to be alarmed about the potential for social instability. The degree of police action and street repression has been at a very high level. Something is missing in this discussion to explain that. Maybe we'll do that the next time. But I want to thank you, Vivek, and the IMF for reaching out from Pennsylvania Avenue to come somewhere else and bring your colleagues here to talk about your latest product. And thank you very much, Peter and Nick, for your extremely sharp contributions. Thank you all.